feeling that she was looking far beyond him, through him. But then the focus of her gaze came back, and she looked directly at him for the first time since he had brought her home. "Safe," she whispered, and closed her eyes. She took one huge breath, and her body relaxed all at once, going limp and heavy, like a dying hare. He held her, both arms wrapped around her as though to save her from drowning, but felt her sink away all the same. He wished to call out to her, not to go, not to leave him alone. She vanished into the depths of sleep, and he yearned after her, wishing her healed, fearing her flight, and bent his head, burying his face in her hair and her scent. The wind banged the open shutters as it passed, and in the dark outside, one owl hooted and another answered, hiding from the rain. Then he cried, soundless, muscles strained to aching that he might not shake with it, that she might not wake to know it. He wept to emptiness and ragged breath, the pillow wet beneath his face. Then lay, exhausted beyond the thought of tiredness, too far from sleep even to recall what it was like. His only comfort was the small, so fragile weight that lay warm upon his heart, breathing. Then her hands rose and rested on him, the tears cool on his face congealing, the white of her, clean as the silent snow that covers char and blood, and breathes peace upon the world. Chapter 30. The Captive. It was a still warm morning, the last of the Indian summer. A woodpecker hammered in the wood nearby, and some insect was making a noise like rasping metal in the tall grass beyond the house. I came downstairs slowly, feeling mildly disembodied, and wishing I were, since the body I had hurt almost everywhere. Mrs. Bug hadn't come this morning. Perhaps she wasn't feeling well. Or perhaps she wasn't sure yet how to deal with seeing me, or what to say to me when she did. My mouth tightened a little, something I realized only because the partially healed split in my lip stung when I did it. I very consciously relaxed my face and went about getting down the coffee things from the kitchen shelf. There was a trail of tiny black ants running along the edge of the shelf, and a swarm of them over the small tin box in which I kept lump sugar. I flicked them off with a few stern swipes of my apron, and made a mental note to see about finding some Avon's root for repellent. That resolve, small as it was, made me feel better and steadier at once. Ever since Hodgepile and his men had turned up at the malting shed, I had been completely at the mercy of someone else, prevented from any sort of independent action. For the first time in days, it seemed much longer, I was able to decide what I was going to do. It seemed a precious liberty. Very well, I thought. What would I do then? I would drink some coffee. Eat a bit of toast? No. I felt gingerly with my tongue. Several teeth on one side were loose, and my jaw muscles so sore that serious chewing was out of the question. Just coffee, then, and while I drank it, I would decide upon the shape of my day. Feeling pleased with this plan, I put back the plain wooden cup, and instead ceremoniously set out my sole china cup and saucer, a delicate bit of porcelain Jocasta had given me, hand-painted with violets. Jamie had poked up the fire earlier, and the kettle was boiling. I dipped out enough water to warm the pot, swished it round, and opened the back door in order to toss it out. Fortunately, I looked first. Ian was sitting cross-legged on the back porch, a small whetstone in one hand, knife in the other. "Good morning to you, Auntie," he said cheerfully, and drew the knife across the stone, making the thin, monotonous, rasping noise I had heard earlier. "Feeling better, then?" "Yes, fine," I assured him. He raised one eyebrow dubiously, looking me over.
Well, better than you look, I hope.
Not that good, I said tartly, and he laughed. He put down the knife and stone and got to his feet. He was much taller than I, nearly Jamie's height, though thinner. He'd inherited his father's whipcord leanness, as well as the elder Ian's sense of humour, and his toughness. He took me by the shoulders and turned me into the sunlight, pursing his lips a little as he inspected me at close range. I blinked up at him, imagining what I must look like. I hadn't had the nerve to look into a mirror yet, but I knew the bruising must be going from blacks and reds to a colourful assortment of blues, greens and yellows. Add in assorted knobbly swellings, flecks of crusty black for the split lip and the scabby bits, and I was undoubtedly quite the picture of health. Ian's soft hazel eyes peered intently into my face with no apparent surprise or distress, though. At last he let go and patted my shoulder gently.
"You'll do, Auntie," he said. "It's still you, isn't it?"
"Yes," I said. And with no warning at all, tears welled up and overflowed. I knew exactly what he'd meant and why he'd said it. And it was true. I felt as though my center had turned unexpectedly to liquid and was gushing out, not from grief, but from relief. I was still me. Fragile, battered, sore and wary, but myself. Only when I recognized that did I realize how much I had feared that I might not be, that I might emerge from shock and find myself irrevocably altered, some vital part forever missing. "I'm all right," I assured Ian, hastily wiping my eyes with the edge of my apron. "Just a bit..."
"I know," he said,
and took the pot from me, tossing the water into the grass by the path.
"It's a bit strange, aye? Coming back."
I took the coffee pot from him, squeezing his hand hard as I did so. He had come back twice from captivity, rescued from Gilles Duncan's strange compound on Jamaica, only to choose later exile with the Mohawk. He had come to manhood on that journey, and I did wonder what parts of himself might have been left behind on the way. "Do you want breakfast, Ian?" I asked, sniffing and dabbing gingerly at my swollen nose.
"Of course I do," he said, grinning. "Come and sit yourself down, Auntie. I'll fetch it."
I followed him inside, filled the coffee pot, and set it to brew, then sat at the table, the sun on my back through the open door, and watched as Ian rummaged the pantry. My mind felt soggy and incapable of thought, but a sense of peace crept over me, gentle as the wavering light through the chestnut trees. Even the small throbbings here and there seemed pleasant, a sense of healing being quietly accomplished. Ian spread an armload of random foodstuffs on the table and sat down across from me.
"All right, Auntie," he asked again, raising one of his father's feathery eyebrows.
"Yes. It's rather like sitting on a soap bubble, though, isn't it?" I glanced at him as I poured the coffee, but he looked down at the chunk of bread he was buttering. I thought a slight smile touched his lips, but couldn't tell for sure.
"Something like," he said quietly.
The heat of the coffee warmed my hands through the china and soothed the raw membranes of my nose and palate. I felt as though I'd been screaming for hours, but didn't recall actually doing any such thing. Had I, with Jamie the night before? I didn't quite want to think about the night before. It was part of the soap bubble feeling. Jamie had been gone when I woke, and I wasn't sure whether I was glad or sorry about that. Ian didn't talk, but ate his way in a businesslike manner through half a loaf with butter and honey, 3 raisin muffins, 2 thick slices of ham, and a jug of milk. Jamie had done the milking, I saw. He always used the blue jug, while Mr. Weems used the white one. I wondered vaguely where Mr. Weems was. I hadn't seen him, and the house felt empty, but didn't really care. It occurred to me that perhaps Jamie had told both Mr. Weems and Mrs. Bug to stay away for a bit, feeling that I might need a little time alone.
"More coffee, Auntie?"
At my nod, Ian rose from the table, reached down the decanter from the shelf, and poured a large slug of whiskey into my cup before refilling it.
"Mam always said it's good for what ails you," he said.
"Your mother is right. Do you want some?" He sniffed at the aromatic fumes but shook his head.
"No, I think not, Auntie. I must have a clear head this morning."
"Really? Why?"
"The porridge in the pot wasn't 9 days old, quite, but it had been there for 3 or 4. Of course, no one had been here to eat it."
I eyed the cement-like glob adhering to my spoon critically, then decided that it was still soft enough to eat, and doused it with honey. Ian was dealing with a mouthful of the same substance, and took a moment to clear it from his palate before replying.
"Uncle Jamie means to ask his questions," he answered,
giving me a cautious glance as he reached for the bread. "Does he?" I said, rather blankly. But before I could inquire what he meant by that, the sound of footsteps on the path announced the arrival of Fergus. He looked as though he'd been sleeping in the woods. Well, of course, I thought, he had been. Or rather, not sleeping. The men had barely stopped to rest in their pursuit of Hodgepile's gang. Fergus had shaved, but his normally fastidious grooming was sadly lacking, and his handsome face was gaunt, the deep eyes shadowed.
"Milady," he murmured,
and unexpectedly bent to kiss my cheek, hand on my shoulder.
"Comment ça va?"
"Très bien, merci," I replied, smiling gingerly. "How are Massali and the children? And our hero, Germaine?" I had asked Jamie about Massali on the way back, and had been assured that she was all right. Germaine, monkey that he was, had gone straight up a tree when he heard Hodgepile's men approaching. He had seen everything from his perch, and as soon as the men departed, had scrambled down, dragged his semi-conscious mother away from the fire, and run for help.
"Ah, Germain," Fergus said,
a faint smile momentarily lifting the shadows of fatigue.
"Nous petit guerrier. He says grand-père has promised him a pistol of his own to shoot bad people with." Grand-père undoubtedly meant it, I reflected.
Germaine couldn't manage a musket, being somewhat shorter than the gun itself. But a pistol would do. In my present state of mind, the fact that Germaine was only 6 didn't seem particularly important. "Have you had breakfast, Fergus?" I pushed the pot toward him.
"Non, merci."
He helped himself to cold biscuit, ham and coffee, though I noticed that he ate without much appetite. We all sat quietly, sipping coffee and listening to the birds. Carolina wrens had built a late nest under the eaves of the house, and the parent birds swooped in and out just above our heads. I could hear the high-pitched cheeping of the nestlings begging, and saw a scatter of twigs and a bit of empty eggshell on the floorboards of the porch. They were nearly ready to fledge, just in time before the real cold weather came. The sight of the brown speckled eggshell reminded me of Monsieur L'Œuf. "Yes, that's what I would do," I decided, with a small sense of relief at having something firm in mind. "I would go and see Massali later, and perhaps Mrs. Bug as well." "Did you see Mrs. Bug this morning?" I asked, turning to Ian. His cabin, little more than a brush-roofed lean-to, lay just beyond the Bugs. He would have passed them on his way to the house.
"Oh, aye,"
he said, looking a little surprised.
"She was sweeping out as I went by. Offered me breakfast, but I said I'd eat here. I kent Uncle Jimmy had a ham, aye?"
He grinned, lifting his 4th ham biscuit in illustration. "So she's all right? I thought she might be ill. She usually comes quite early." Ian nodded and took an enormous bite of the biscuit.
"Aye, I expect she's busy, minding the kirmach."
My fragile sense of well-being cracked like the wren's eggs.
A Kiamach was a captive.
In my soggy-minded euphoria, I had somehow managed to forget Lionel Brown's existence. Ian's remark that Jamie meant to ask questions this morning dropped suddenly into context, as did Fergus's presence. And the knife Ian had been sharpening.
"Where is Jamie?" I asked, rather faintly. "Have you seen him?"
"Oh, aye," Ian said, looking surprised. He swallowed and gestured toward the door with his chin. "He's just out in the woodshed making new shingles. He says the roof sprung a leak." No sooner had he said this than the sound of hammering came from the roof far above. Of course, I thought. First things first. But then I supposed Lionel Brown wasn't going anywhere after all. Perhaps I should go and see Mr. Brown, I said, swallowing. Ian and Fergus exchanged glances.
No, Auntie, you shouldn't,
Ian said quite calmly, but with an air of authority I wasn't accustomed to seeing in him.
Whatever do you mean?
I stared at him, but he merely went on eating, though a trifle more slowly.
Milor says you should not,
Fergus amplified, drizzling a spoonful of honey into his coffee.
He says what?
I asked incredulously. Neither of them would look at me, but they seemed to draw together, emanating a reluctant sort of stubborn resistance. Either one would do anything I asked, I knew, except defy Jamie. If Jamie thought I ought not to see Mr. Brown, I wasn't going to do it with the assistance of either Ian or Fergus. I dropped the spoon back into my bowl of porridge, uneaten lumps still adhering to it. "Did he happen to mention why he thinks I ought not to visit Mr. Brown?" I asked, calmly, under the circumstances. Both men looked surprised, then exchanged another look, this one longer.
"No, milady," Fergus said, his voice carefully neutral.
There was a brief silence, during which both of them seemed to be considering. Then Fergus glanced at Ian, deferring to him with a shrug.
"Well, d'you see, Auntie," Ian said carefully, "we do mean to question the fellow." "And we will have answers," Fergus said, eyes on the spoon with which he was stirring his coffee. "And when Uncle Jamie is satisfied that he has told us what he can..."
Ian had laid his newly sharpened knife on the table beside his plate. He picked it up and thoughtfully drew it down the length of a cold sausage, which promptly split open with an aromatic burst of sage and garlic. He looked up then and met my eyes directly, and I realized that while I might still be me, Ian was no longer the boy he used to be. Not at all.
"You'll kill him, then," I said,
my lips feeling numb in spite of the hot coffee.
"Oh, yes," Fergus said very softly. "I expect that we shall."
He met my eyes now, too. There was a bleak, grim look about him, and his deep-set eyes were hard as stone.
"It wasn't him," I said.
"It couldn't have been. He'd already broken his leg when..." I didn't seem to have enough air to finish my sentences.
"And Masali. It wasn't... I don't think he..."
Something behind Ian's eyes changed as he grasped my meaning. His lips pressed tight for a moment, and he nodded.
"As well for him, then," he said shortly.
"As well,"
Fergus echoed. "But I think it will not matter in the end. We kill the others. Why should he live?"
He pushed back from the table, leaving his coffee undrunk.
"I think I will go, cousin."
"Aye. I'll come too, then."
Ian shoved his plate away, nodding to me.
"Will you tell Uncle Jimmy we've gone ahead, Auntie?"
I nodded, numbly, and watched them go, vanishing one after the other under the big chestnut tree that overhung the trail leading to the bug's cabin. Mechanically, I got up and began slowly to clear away the remains of the makeshift breakfast. I really wasn't sure whether I minded a lot about Mr. Brown or not. On the one hand, I did disapprove on principle of torture and cold-blooded murder. On the other, while it was true enough that Brown hadn't personally violated or injured me, and he had tried to make Hodgepyle release me, he'd been all in favour of killing me later. And I hadn't the slightest doubt that he would have drowned me in the gorge, had Tebby not intervened. No, I thought, carefully rinsing my cup and drying it on my apron. Perhaps I didn't really mind terribly about Mr. Brown. Still, I felt uneasy and upset. What I did mind about, I realised, were Ian and Fergus. And Jamie. The fact was, killing someone in the heat of battle is a quite different thing from executing a man. And I knew that. Did they? Well, Jamie did. "And may your vow redeem me." He had whispered that to me the night before. It was just about the last thing I recalled him saying, in fact. Well, all right, but I would greatly prefer that he didn't feel in need of redemption to start with. And as for Ian and Fergus... Fergus had fought in the Battle of Preston Pans at the age of 10. I still remembered the face of the small French orphan, soot-smeared and dazed with shock and exhaustion, looking down at me from his perch atop a captured cannon. "I killed an English soldier, madame," he'd said to me. "He fell down, and I stuck him with my knife." And Ian, a 15-year-old, weeping in remorse because he'd thought he'd accidentally killed an intruder to Jamie's Edinburgh print shop. God knew what he had done since. He wasn't talking. I had a sudden vision of Fergus's hook, dark with blood, and Ian silhouetted in the dark. "And I," he'd said, echoing Jamie, "it is myself who kills for her." It was 1773. And on the 18th of April, in 75, the shot heard round the world was already being loaded. The room was warm, but I shuddered convulsively. What in the name of God did I think I could shield them from? Any of them? A sudden roar from the roof above startled me out of my thoughts. I walked out into the dooryard and looked up, shading my eyes against the morning sun. Jamie was sitting astride the roof tree, rocking to and fro over one hand which he held curled into his belly. "What's going on up there?" I called.
"I've got a splinter,"
came the terse answer, obviously spoken through clenched teeth. I wanted to laugh, if only as a small escape from tension, but didn't.
"Well, come down then. I'll pull it out."
"I'm no finished."
"I don't care," I said, suddenly impatient with him. "Come down this minute. I want to talk to you."
A bag of nails hit the grass with a sudden clank, followed instantly by the hammer.
"First things first, then."
Technically, I supposed it was a splinter. It was a 2-inch sliver of cedar wood, and he'd driven it completely under the nail of his middle finger, nearly to the first joint.
"Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ!"
"Aye," he agreed, looking a little pale.
"You might see that."
The protruding stub was too short to grip with my fingers. I hauled him into the surgery and jerked the sliver out with forceps before one could say Jack Robinson. Jamie was saying a good deal more than Jack Robinson, mostly in French, which is an excellent language for swearing.
"You're going to lose that nail," I observed, submerging the offended digit in a small bowl of alcohol and water.
Blood bloomed from it like ink from a squid.
"To hell with the nail," he said, gritting his teeth. "Cut the whole bloody finger off and had done with it." "Merde, chef."
"The Chinese used to... well, no, I suppose they still do, come to think of it. Shove splinters of bamboo under people's fingernails to make them talk."
"Christ! Tu me casse les couilles."
"Obviously a very effective technique," I said, lifting his hand out of the bowl and wrapping the finger tightly in a strip of linen. "Were you trying it out before using it on Lionel Brown?"
I tried to speak lightly, keeping my eyes on his hand. I felt his own gaze fix on me, and he snorted.
"What in the name of saints and archangels was we in telling us, Asenach?"
"That you meant to question the man and get answers."
"I do, and I shall," he said shortly. "So?"
Fergus and Ian seemed to think that you might be moved to use any means necessary, I said with some delicacy. "They're more than willing to help."
"I imagine they are."
The first agony had abated somewhat. He breathed more deeply, and colour was beginning to come back into his face.
"Fergus has a right. It was his wife attacked."
Ian seemed... I hesitated, searching for the right word. Ian had seemed so calm as to be terrifying. "You didn't call Roger to help with the questioning?"
"No, not yet."
One corner of his mouth tucked in.
"Roger Mack's a good fighter, but no the sort to scare a man, save he's truly roused. He's no deceit in him at all."
"Whereas you, Ian and Fergus?"
"Oh, aye," he said dryly. "Wily as snakes, the lot of us. You've only to look at Roger Mack to see how safe their time must be, him and the lass. A bit of a comfort, that," he added, the tuck growing deeper. "To ken things will get better, I mean."
I could see that he was trying to change the subject, which wasn't a good sign. I made a small snorting noise, but it hurt my nose.
"And you're not truly roused? Is that what you're telling me?"
He made a much more successful snorting noise, but didn't reply. He tilted his head to one side, watching as I laid out a square of gauze and began to rub dried leaves of comfrey into it. I didn't know how to say what was troubling me, but he plainly saw that something was. "Will you kill him?" I asked boldly, keeping my eyes on the jar of honey. It was made of brown glass, and the light glowed through it as though it were a huge ball of clear amber. Jamie sat still, watching me. I could feel his speculative gaze, though I didn't look up.
"I think so," he said.
My hands had started to tremble, and I pressed them on the surface of the table to still them.
"Not today," he added. "If I kill him, I shall do it properly."
I wasn't sure I wanted to know what constituted a proper killing, in his opinion, but he told me anyway.
"If he dies at my hand, it will be in the open, before witnesses who ken the truth of the matter, and him standing upright. I will not have it said that I killed a helpless man, whatever his crime."
"Oh." I swallowed, feeling mildly ill, and took a pinch of powdered bloodroot to add to the salve I was making. It had a faint astringent smell which seemed to help. "But you might let him live?"
"Perhaps. I suppose I might ransom him to his brother, depending."
"Do you know, you sound quite like your Uncle Colum. He would have thought it through like that."
"Do I?"
The corner of his mouth turned up slightly.
"Shall I take that as a compliment, Asenach?"
"I suppose you might as well."
"I will,"
he said thoughtfully. The stiff fingers tapped on the tabletop, and he winced slightly as the movement jarred the injured one.
"Colum had a castle and armed clansmen at his beck. I should have some difficulty in defending this house against a raid, perhaps."
"That's what you mean by depending." I felt quite uneasy at this. The thought of armed raiders attacking the house hadn't occurred to me. And I saw that Jamie's forethought in storing Mr. Brown off our premises had perhaps not been entirely for the purpose of sparing my sensibilities.
"One of the things."
I mixed a bit of honey with my powdered herbs, then scooped a small dollop of purified bear grease into the mortar. "I suppose," I said, eyes on my mixing, "that there's no point in turning Lionel Brown over to the authorities?"
"Which authorities did you have in mind, Asenach?"
he asked dryly. "A good question. This part of the back country hadn't yet formed nor joined a county, though a movement was afoot to that purpose. Were Jamie to deliver Mr. Brown to the sheriff of the nearest county for trial? Well, no, perhaps not a good idea. Brownsville lay just within the borders of the nearest county, and the current sheriff was, in fact, named Brown. I bit my lip, considering. In times of stress, I tended still to respond as what I was, a civilized Englishwoman, accustomed to rely on the sureties of government and law. Well, all right. Jamie had a point. The 20th century had its own dangers, but some things had improved. This was nearly 1774, though, and the colonial government was already showing cracks and fault lines, signs of the collapse to come. I suppose we could take him to Cross Creek. Farquhar Campbell was a justice of the peace there, and a friend to Jamie's aunt, Jocasta Cameron. Or to New Bern? Governor Martin and the bulk of the Royal Council were in New Bern, 300 miles away. Maybe Hillsborough? That was the centre of the circuit court.
Mm-hmm.
This noise denoted a marked disinclination to lose several weeks' work in order to haul Mr. Brown before any of these seats of justice, let alone entrust a matter of importance to the highly unreliable and frequently corrupt judicial system. I looked up and met his eye, humorous but bleak. If I responded as what I was, so did Jamie. And Jamie was a Highland laird, accustomed to follow his own laws and fight his own battles. But, I began.
Sassenach, he said,
quite gently.
What of the others?
The others. I stopped moving, paralysed by the sudden memory, a large band of black figures coming out of the wood with the sun behind them. But that group had split in two, intending to meet again in Brownsville in 3 days' time. Today, in fact. For the moment, presumably no one from Brownsville yet knew what had happened, that Hodgepyle and his men were dead, or that Lionel Brown was now a captive on the ridge. Given the speed with which news spread in the mountains, though, it would be public knowledge within a week. In the aftermath of shock, I had somehow overlooked the fact that there were still a number of bandits at large. And while I didn't know who they were, they knew both who I was and where I was. Would they realize that I couldn't identify them? Or be willing to take that risk? Obviously, Jamie wasn't willing to take the risk of leaving the ridge to escort Lionel Brown anywhere, whether or not he decided to let the man live. The thought of the others had brought something important back to me, though. It might not be the best time to mention it. But then again, there wasn't going to be a good one. I took a deep breath, squaring myself for it. Jamie. The tone of my voice jerked him immediately from whatever he'd been thinking. He looked sharply at me, one eyebrow raised. I have to tell you something. He paled a little, but reached out at once, grasping my hand. He took a deep breath of his own and nodded.
I?
Oh, I said, realizing that he thought I meant that I had suddenly arrived at a point where I needed to tell him the grisly details of my experiences. Not that. Not exactly. I squeezed his hand, though, and held on while I told him about Donna.
Another, he said.
He sounded slightly stunned.
Another one?
Another, I confirmed. The thing is, I don't remember seeing him dead. The eerie sense of that dawn returned to me. I had very sharp, distinct memories. But they were disjointed, so fractured as to bear no relation to the whole. An ear? I remembered an ear, thick and cup-shaped as a woodland fungus. It was shaded in the most exquisite tones of purple, brown, and indigo, shadowed in the carved walls of the inner parts, nearly translucent at the rim, perfect in the light of a sunbeam that cut through the fronds of a hemlock to touch it. I recalled that ear so perfectly that I could almost reach into my memory and touch it myself. But I had no idea whose ear it had been. Was the hair that lay behind it brown, black, reddish, straight, wavy, grey? And the face? I didn't know. If I had looked, I hadn't seen.
He shot me a sharp look.
And you think he's maybe not?
Maybe not.
I swallowed the taste of dust, pine needles and blood, and breathed the comforting fresh scent of buttermilk. I warned him, you see. I told him you were coming, and that he didn't want you to find him with me. When you attacked the camp, he might have run. He struck me as a coward, certainly. But I don't know.
He nodded and sighed heavily. Can you recall, do you think?
I asked hesitantly. When you showed me the dead,
did you look at them?
No, he said softly. I wasn't looking at anything save you.
His eyes had been on our linked hands. He raised them now and looked at my face, troubled and searching. I lifted his hand and laid my cheek against his knuckles, closing my eyes for an instant.
I'll be all right, I said. The thing is, I said,
and stopped.
Aye.
If he did run,
where do you suppose he'd go? He closed his own eyes and drew a deep breath.
To Brownsville, he said, in resignation. And if he did, Richard Brown kens already what's become of Hodgepile and his men, and likely thinks his brother is dead as well.
Oh.
I swallowed and changed the subject slightly.
Why did you tell Ian I wasn't to be allowed to see Mr. Brown?
I didn't see that. But I think it best if you didn't see him, that much is true.
Because?
Because you've an oath upon you, he said,
sounding mildly surprised that I didn't understand immediately.
Can you see a man injured and leave him to suffer?
The ointment was ready. I unwrapped his finger, which had stopped bleeding, and tamped as much of the salve under the damaged nail as I could manage.
Probably not, I said, eyes on my work. But why?
If you mend him, care for him, and then I decide he must die.
His eyes rested on me, questioning.
How would that be for you?
Well, that would be a bit awkward, I said, taking a deep breath to steady myself.
I wrapped a thin strip of linen around the nail and tied it neatly.
Still, though,
you wish to care for him? Why?
He sounded curious, but not angry.
Is your oath so strong, then?
No. I put both hands on the table to brace myself. My knees seemed suddenly weak.
Because I'm glad they're dead, I whispered, looking down.
My hands were raw, and I fumbled while I worked because my fingers were still swollen. There were deep purple marks still sunk in the skin of my wrists.
And I'm very much...
What? Afraid? Afraid of the men. Afraid of myself. Thrilled in a horrible sort of way.
Ashamed, I said. Terribly ashamed.
I glanced up at him.
I hate it.
He held out his hand to me, waiting. He knew better than to touch me. I couldn't have borne being touched just then. I didn't take it, not at once, though I longed to. I looked away, speaking rapidly to Adso, who had materialized on the countertop and was regarding me with a bottomless green gaze. If I keep thinking,
If I were to see him, help him. Christ, I don't want to. I don't at all. But if I could, perhaps that would help somehow. I looked up then, feeling haunted. Make amends?
For being glad they are dead, and for wanting him dead too, Jamie suggested gently.
I nodded, feeling as though a small, heavy weight had lifted with the speaking of the words. I didn't remember taking his hand, but it was tight on mine. Blood from his finger was seeping through the fresh bandage, but he paid no attention.
"Do you want to kill him?" I asked.
He looked at me for a long moment before replying.
"Oh, aye," he said very softly. "But for now, his life is surety for yours. For all of us, perhaps. And so he lives.
For now.
But I will ask questions, and I shall have answers."
I sat in my surgery for some time after he left. Emerging slowly from shock, I had felt safe, surrounded by home and friends, by Jamie. Now I must come to grips with the fact that nothing was safe. Not I, not home, nor friends. And certainly not Jamie.
"But then, you never are you, you bloody Scot?" I said aloud,
and laughed weakly. Feeble as it was, it made me feel better. I rose with sudden decision and began to tidy my cupboards, lining up bottles in order of size, sweeping out bits of scattered herbs, throwing away solutions gone stale or suspect. I had meant to go and visit Masali, but Fergus had told me during breakfast that Jamie had sent her with the children and Lizzie to stay with the MacGillivrays, where she would be cared for and safe. If there was safety in numbers, the MacGillivrays' house was certainly the place for it. Located near Woolham's Creek, the MacGillivrays' home place adjoined Ronnie Sinclair's cooper's shop, and enclosed a seething mass of cordial humanity, including not only Robin and Uta MacGillivray, their son Manfred, their daughter Senga, but also Ronnie, who boarded with them. The usual mob scene was augmented intermittently by Senga MacGillivray's fiancé, Heinrich Strasser, and his German relatives from Salem, and by Inga and Hilda, their husbands and children, and their husbands' relatives. Add in the men who congregated daily in Ronnie's shop, a convenient stopping place on the road to and from Woolham's Mill, and likely no one would even notice Masali and her family in the midst of that mob. Surely no one would seek to harm her there. But for me to go and see her... Highland tact and delicacy were one thing. Highland hospitality and curiosity were another. If I stayed peacefully at home, I would likely be left in peace, at least for a while. If I were to set foot near the MacGillivrays, I blenched at the thought and hastily decided that perhaps I would visit Masali tomorrow, or the next day. Jamie had assured me she was all right, only shocked and bruised. The house stood around me in peace. No modern background of furnace, fans, plumbing, refrigerators. No whoosh of pilot lights or hum of compressors. Just the occasional creak of beam or floorboard and the odd muffled scrape of a wood wasp building its nest up under the eaves. I looked round the ordered world of my surgery. Ranks of shining jars and bottles, linen screens laden with drying arrowroot and masses of lavender, bunches of nettle and yarrow and rosemary hanging overhead, the bottle of ether, sunlight glowing on it. Adso, curled on the countertop, tail tucked neatly around his feet, eyes half closed in purring contemplation. Home. A small shiver ran down my spine. I wanted nothing more than to be alone, safe and alone, in my own home. Safe. I had a day, perhaps two, in which home would still be safe.
And then I realized that I'd been standing still for some moments, staring blankly into a box of yellow nightshade berries, round and shiny as marbles, very poisonous, and a slow, painful death. My eyes rose to the ether, quick and merciful. If Jamie did decide to kill Lionel Brown... But no. In the open, he'd said, standing on his feet before witnesses. Slowly, I closed the box and put it back on the shelf. What then? There were always chores that could be done, but nothing pressing, with no one clamouring to be fed, clothed, or cared for. Feeling quite odd, I wandered round the house for a bit, and finally went into Jamie's study, where I poked among the books on the shelf there, settling at last on Henry Fielding's Tom Jones. I couldn't think how long it had been since I had read a novel. And in the daytime. Feeling pleasantly wicked, I sat by the open window in my surgery and resolutely entered a world far from my own. I lost track of time, moving only to brush away roving insects that came through the window or to absently scratch Adso's head when he nudged against me. Occasional thoughts of Jamie and Lionel Brown drifted through the back of my mind, but I shooed them away like the leafhoppers and midges who landed on my page, drifting in through the window. Whatever was happening in the bug's cabin had happened, or would happen. I simply couldn't think about it. As I read, the soap bubble formed around me once more, filled with perfect stillness. The sun was halfway down the sky before faint pangs of hunger began to stir. It was, as I looked up, rubbing my forehead and wondering vaguely whether there was any ham left, that I saw a man standing in the doorway to the surgery. I shrieked and leapt to my feet, sending Henry Fielding flying.
"Your pardon, mistress,"
Thomas Christie blurted, looking nearly as startled as I felt.
"I didn't realize that you'd not heard me."
"No, I was reading." I gestured foolishly toward the book on the floor. My heart was pounding, and blood surged to and fro in my body, seemingly at random, so that my face flushed, my ears throbbed, and my hands tingled, all out of control. He stooped and picked the book up, smoothing its cover with the careful attitude of one who values books, though the volume itself was battered, its cover scarred with rings where wet glasses or bottles had been set down upon it. Jamie had got it from the owner of an ordinary in Cross Creek, in partial trade for a load of firewood. Some customer had left it months before.
"Is there no one here to care for you?" he asked, frowning as he looked around. "Shall I go and fetch my daughter to you?"
"No. I mean, I don't need anyone. I'm quite all right." "What about you?" I asked quickly, forestalling any further expressions of concern on his part. He glanced at my face, then hastily away. Eyes fixed carefully in the vicinity of my collarbone, he laid the book on the table and held out his right hand, wrapped in a cloth.
"I beg your pardon, mistress. I wouldn't intrude, save..."
I was already unwrapping the hand. He'd ripped the incision in his right hand, probably, I realized, with a small tightening of the belly, in the course of the fight with the bandits. The wound was no great matter, but there were bits of dirt and debris in the wound, and the edges were red and gaping, raw surfaces clouded with a film of pus. "You should have come at once," I said, though with no tone of rebuke.
I knew perfectly well why he hadn't, and, in fact, I should have been in no state to deal with him if he had.
He shrugged slightly, but didn't bother replying. I sat him down and went to fetch things. Luckily, there was some of the antiseptic salve left that I'd made for Jamie's splinter. That, a quick alcohol wash, fresh sutures, clean bandage. He was turning the pages of Tom Jones slowly, lips pursed in concentration. Evidently, Henry Fielding would do as anaesthetic for the job at hand. I shouldn't need to fetch a Bible. "Do you read novels?" I asked,
meaning no rudeness, but merely surprised that he might countenance anything so frivolous. He hesitated.
Yes.
He took a very deep breath as I submerged his hand in the bowl, but it contained only water, soap root, and a very small amount of alcohol, and he let the breath go with a sigh.
"Have you read Tom Jones before?" I asked, making conversation to relax him.
"Not precisely, though I know the story. My wife..."
He stopped abruptly. He'd never mentioned his wife before. I suppose that it was sheer relief at not experiencing agony yet that had made him talkative. He seemed to realize that he must complete the sentence, though, and went on reluctantly.
"My wife read novels."
"Did she?" I murmured, setting about the job of debridement.
"Did she like them?"
"I suppose that she must have."
There was something odd in his voice that made me glance up from the job at hand. He caught the glance and looked away, flushing.
"I did not approve of reading novels, then."
He was quiet for a moment, holding his hand steady. Then he blurted,
"I burnt her books."
That sounded rather more like the response I would have expected of him.
"She couldn't have been pleased about that," I said mildly, and he shot me a startled glance, as though the question of his wife's reaction was so irrelevant as to be unworthy of remark.
What caused you to alter your opinion?" I asked, concentrating on the bits of debris I was picking out of the wound with my forceps. Splinters and shreds of bark. What had he been doing? Wielding a club of some kind, I thought. A tree branch.
I breathed deeply, concentrating on the job to avoid thinking of the bodies in the clearing. He moved his legs restively. I was hurting him a bit now.
In Ardsmuir.
What? You read it in prison?
No. We had no books there.
He took a long breath, glanced at me, then away, and fixed his eyes in the corner of the room where an enterprising spider had taken advantage of Mrs. Bug's temporary absence to set up web-keeping.
"In fact, I have never actually read it. Mr. Fraser, though, was accustomed to recount the story to the other prisoners." "He has a fine memory," he added, rather grudgingly.
"Yes, he does," I murmured. "I'm not going to stitch it. It will be better if the wound's left to heal by itself. I'm afraid the scar won't be as neat," I added regretfully. "But I think it will heal up all right." I spread salve thickly over the injury and pulled the edges of the wound together as tightly as I could, without cutting off the circulation. Bree had been experimenting with adhesive bandages and had produced something quite useful in the way of small butterfly shapes, made of starched linen and pine tar.
"So you liked Tom Jones, did you?"
I said, returning to the subject.
"I shouldn't have thought you'd find him an admirable character. Not much of a moral example, I mean."
"I don't," he said bluntly. "But I saw that fiction," he pronounced the word gingerly as though it was something dangerous, "is perhaps not, as I had thought, merely an inducement to idleness and wicked fancy."
"Oh, isn't it?" I said, amused, but trying not to smile because of my lip. "What are its redeeming characteristics, do you think?"
Well...
His brows drew together in thought.
"I found it most remarkable that what is essentially nothing save a confection of lies should somewise still contrive to exert a beneficial effect. For it did," he concluded, sounding still rather surprised.
"Really? How was that?"
He tilted his head, considering.
"It was distraction, to be sure. In such conditions, distraction is not evil," he assured me. "While it is, of course, more desirable to escape into prayer."
"Oh, of course," I murmured.
"But beyond that consideration, it drew the men together.
You would not think that such men, Highlanders, crofters, that they would find themselves in particular sympathy with such situations, such persons.
He waved his free hand at the book, indicating such persons as Squire Allworthy and Lady Bellaston, I supposed.
But they would talk it over for hours. Whilst we laboured the next day, they would wonder why Ensign Northerton had done as he had with regard to Miss Weston, and argue whether they themselves would or would not have behaved so.
His face lightened a little, recalling something,
and invariably a man would shake his head and say, "At least I've never been treated in that manner." He might be starved, cold, covered in sores, permanently separated from his family and customary circumstances, and yet he could take comfort in never having suffered such vicissitudes as had befallen these imaginary beings.
He actually smiled, shaking his head at the thought, and I thought the smile much improved him. I'd finished the job and laid his hand on the table.
"Thank you," I said quietly.
He looked startled.
"What? Why?"
"I'm assuming that that injury was perhaps the result of battle done on my behalf," I said. I touched his hand lightly. I took a deep breath. "Thank you."
"Oh."
He looked thoroughly taken aback at this and quite embarrassed. He pushed back the stool and rose, looking flustered. I rose as well. "You'll need to have fresh salve put on every day," I said, resuming a businesslike tone. "I'll make up some more. You can come, or send Mulver to fetch it." He nodded, but said nothing, having evidently exhausted his supply of sociability for the day. I saw his eye linger on the cover of the book, though, and on impulse offered it to him. "Would you like to borrow it? You should really read it for yourself. I'm sure Jamie can't have recalled all the details."
"Oh."
He looked startled and pursed his lips, frowning as though suspecting it was a trap of some sort. When I insisted, though, he took the book, picking it up with an expression of guarded avidity that made me wonder how long it had been since he had had any book other than the Bible to read. He nodded thanks to me and donned his hat, turning to go. Upon a moment's impulse, I asked, "Did you ever have the chance to apologize to your wife?" That was a mistake. His face tightened into coldness, and his eyes went flat as a snake's. "No," he said shortly. I thought for a moment that he would put the book down and refuse to take it. But instead, he tightened his lips, tucked the volume more securely under his arm, and left without further farewell. Chapter 31. And so to bed. No one else came. By the time night fell, I was beginning to feel rather edgy, starting at noises, searching the deepening shadows under the chestnut trees for lurking men, or worse. I thought I should cook something. Surely Jamie and Ian intended coming home for supper. Or perhaps I should go down to the cabin, join Roger and Bree. But I flinched from the notion of being exposed to any kind of solicitude, no matter how well meant. And while I hadn't yet got up the nerve to look in a mirror, was reasonably sure that the sight of me would frighten Jemmy, or at least lead to a lot of questions. I didn't want to have to try to explain to him what had happened to me. I was fairly sure that Jamie had told Brianna to stay away for a bit, and that was good. I really was in no shape to pretend to be all right. Not quite yet. Dithering round the kitchen, I picked things up and put them down pointlessly. I opened the drawers of the sideboard and closed them. Then opened the second one again, the one where Jamie kept his pistols. Most of the pistols were gone. Only the gilt-trimmed one that didn't shoot straight was left, with a few loads and a tiny powder horn, the sort made for fancy dueling pistols.
Hand-shaking only a little, I loaded it and poured a bit of powder into the firing pan. When the back door opened, quite some time later, I was sitting at the table, a copy of Don Quixote lying in front of me, pointing the pistol with both hands at the door. Ian froze momentarily.
"You'd never hit anyone with that gun at this distance, Auntie," he said mildly, coming in.
"They wouldn't know that, would they?" I set the pistol down gingerly. My palms were damp and my fingers ached. He nodded, taking the point, and sat down. "Where's Jamie?" I asked.
"Washing." "Are you well, Auntie?"
His soft hazel eyes took a casual but careful estimation of my state.
"No, but I'll do."
I hesitated. "And Mr. Brown, did he tell you anything?"
Ian made a derogatory noise. "Pissed himself when Uncle Jamie took the dirt from his belt to clean his fingernails. We didn't touch him, Auntie. Didn't fash yourself."
Jamie came in then, clean-shaven, his skin cold and fresh from the well-water, hair damp at his temples. Despite that, he looked tired to death, the lines of his face cut deep, and his eyes shadowed. The shadows lifted a bit, though, when he saw me and the pistol.
"It's all right, Ian," he said softly, touching my shoulder as he sat down beside me. "I've men set to watch the house, just in case. Though I didn't expect any trouble for some days yet."
My breath went out in a long sigh. "You could have told me that." He glanced at me, surprised.
"I thought you'd know. Surely you wouldn't think I'd leave you unprotected, Sassenach."
I shook my head, momentarily unable to speak. Had I been in any condition to think logically, of course I wouldn't. As it was, I had spent most of the afternoon in a state of quiet and unnecessary terror, imagining, remembering.
"I'm sorry, lass,"
he said softly, and put a large cold hand on mine.
"I shouldn't have left you alone. I thought..."
I shook my head, but put my other hand over his, pressing tight. "No, you were right. I couldn't have borne any company beyond Sancho Panza." He glanced at Don Quixote, then at me, brows raised. The book was in Spanish, which I didn't happen to speak. "Well, some of it was close to French, and I did know the story," I said. I took a deep breath, taking what comfort I could in the warmth of the fire, the flicker of the candle, and the proximity of the two of them, large, solid, pragmatic, and, outwardly at least, imperturbable.
"Is there any food, Auntie?" Ian inquired, getting up to look.
Lacking any appetite myself and too jittery to focus on anything, I hadn't eaten dinner nor made anything for supper. But there was always food in that house, and without any particular fuss, Jamie and Ian had equipped themselves in short order with the remains of a cold partridge pie, several hard-cooked eggs, a dish of piccalilli, and half a loaf of bread, which they sliced up and toasted over the fire on a fork, buttering the slices and cramming them into me in a manner brooking no argument. Hot buttered toast is immensely comforting, even nibbled tentatively with a sore jaw. With food in my stomach, I began to feel much calmer and capable of inquiring what they had learned from Lionel Brown.
"He put it all on hodge pile," Jamie told me, loading piccalilli onto a slice of pie. "He would, of course."
"You didn't meet Arvin Hodgepile," I said with a small shiver. To talk to, I mean." He shot me a sharp look, but didn't address that matter any further. Instead, leaving it to Ian to explain Lionel Brown's version of events. It had started with him and his brother Richard establishing their committee of safety. This, he had insisted, was intended as public service, pure and simple. Jamie snorted at that, but didn't interrupt. Most of the male inhabitants of Brownsville had joined the committee. Most of the homesteaders and small farmers nearby had not. Still,
So far, so good. The committee had dealt with a number of small matters, meting out justice in cases of assault, theft and the like, and if they had appropriated the odd hog or deer carcass by way of payment for their trouble, there hadn't been too much complaint.
"There's a great deal of feeling still about the regulation," Ian explained, frowning as he sliced another piece of bread. "The Browns didn't adjoin the regulation. They'd no need to, as their cousin was sheriff, and half the courthouse ring are Browns or married to Browns."
Corruption, in other words, had been on their side. Regulator sentiment still ran high in the back country, even though the main leaders of the movement, such as Herman Husband and James Hunter, had left the colony. In the aftermath of Alamans, most regulators had grown more cautious of expressing themselves, but several regulator families who lived near Brownsville had become vocal in their criticism of the Browns' influence on local politics and business.
"Tige O'Brien was one of those?" I asked, feeling the buttered toast coalesce into a small, hard lump in my stomach.
Jamie had told me what had happened to the O'Briens, and I'd seen Roger's face when he'd come back.
Jamie nodded, not looking up from his pie.
"Enter Arvin Hodgepile," he said, and took a ferocious bite.
Hodgepile, having neatly escaped the constraints of the British Army by pretending to die in the warehouse fire at Cross Creek, had set about making a living in various unsavoury ways. And water, having a strong tendency to seek its own level, had ended up with a small gang of like-minded thugs. This gang had begun simply enough by robbing anyone they came across, holding up taverns and the like. This sort of behaviour tends to attract attention, though, and with various constables, sheriffs, committees of safety and the like on their trail, the gang had retired from the Piedmont, where they began, and moved up into the mountains, where they could find isolated settlements and homesteads. They had also begun killing their victims to avoid the nuisance of identification and pursuit.
"Or most of them," Ian murmured.
He regarded the half-eaten egg in his hand for a moment, then put it down. In his career with the army in Cross Creek, Hodgepile had made various contacts with a number of river traders and coastal smugglers. Some dealt in furs, others in anything that would bring a profit.
"And it occurred to them," Jamie said, drawing a deep breath, "that girls and women and young boys are more profitable than almost anything. Save whiskey, maybe."
The corner of his mouth twitched, but it wasn't a smile.
"Our Mr. Brown insists he'd nothing to do with us," Ian added, a cynical note in his voice, "nor had his brother or their committee."
"But how did the Browns get involved with Hodgepile's gang?" I asked. "And what did they do with the people they kidnapped?" The answer to the first question was that it had been the happy outcome of a botched robbery.
"You recall Aaron Beardsley's old place, aye?"
"I do," I said, wrinkling my nose in reflex at the memory of that wretched sty, then emitting a small cry and clapping both hands over my abused appendage. Jamie glanced at me and put another bit of bread on his toasting fork.
"Well, so," he went on, ignoring my protest that I was full, "the Browns took it over, of course, when they adopted the wee lass. They cleaned it out, stocked it fresh, and went on using it as a trading post."
The Cherokee and Catawba had been accustomed to come to the place, horrid as it was, when Aaron Beardsley had operated as an Indian trader and had continued to do business with the new management, a very beneficial and profitable arrangement all round.
"Which is what Hodgepile saw," Ian put in.
The Hodgepile gang, with their usual straightforward methods of doing business, had walked in, shot the couple in charge, and begun systematically looting the place. The couple's 11-year-old daughter, who had fortunately been in the barn when the gang arrived, had slipped out, mounted a mule, and ridden hell for leather for Brownsville and help.
By good fortune, she had encountered the Committee of Safety returning from some errand, and brought them back in time to confront the robbers. There then ensued what in later years would be called a Mexican standoff. The Browns had the house surrounded. Hodgepile, however, had Alicia Beardsley Brown, the 2-year-old girl who legally owned the trading post and who had been adopted by the Browns upon the death of her putative father. Hodgepile had enough food and ammunition inside the trading post to withstand a siege of weeks. The Browns were disinclined to set fire to their valuable property in order to drive him out, or to risk the girl's life by storming the place. After a day or two, during which desultory shots were exchanged, and the members of the committee became increasingly edgy at having to camp in the woods surrounding the trading post, a flag of truce had been waved from the upper window, and Richard Brown had gone inside to parley with Hodgepile. The result being a wary sort of murder.